This is VOA News coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. Thousands of people held a march today in the Russian far eastern city of Khabarovsk, the third straight weekend of protests aimed at President Vladimir Putin. At the core of the crisis, this month's detention of the popular regional governor Sergei Fergal on murder charges, allegations he denies. Supporters say Fergal's arrest was politically motivated, that he's being punished for defeating a candidate from Putin's United Russia Party in 2018. There was more street violence in the city of Portland, Oregon, on the west coast of the United States overnight. Once again, it was centered at a downtown federal courthouse, where a coalition of thousands of demonstrators tossed fireworks at the building and scuffled with federal agents who used tear gas against them. The Trump administration has sent a federal force into the city, which he says will protect U.S. buildings. Local officials have objected to the intervention. The Federal Protective Service cleared the area of protesters after declaring an unlawful assembly. There was a picture of heavy security today outside the U.S. consulate in the Chinese city of Chengdu. American staff members inside face a deadline in 2 days to leave the country. China yesterday ordered the facility in Sichuan province to shut down in response to a U.S. demand that Beijing close its consulate in Houston, Texas. The actions have heightened tensions between the world's two largest economies. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called the Houston consulate a hub of Chinese spying and intellectual property theft. As was the case in Houston, the U.S. mission in Chengdu was given 72 hours to get its people out. Singapore's 68-year-old Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong today named a largely unchanged cabinet following an election win this month. Lee said because of the pandemic, he may delay his plan to step down. The Prime Minister said, quote, "A lot will depend on how events unfold, and all I can say is I will see this through." More news online at voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. Reuters reports that dozens of countries have reported record single-day increases in coronavirus infections over the past week, about double the number of the previous week. It notes there are new outbreaks being reported every day. Ukraine is an example. It has seen 1,100 new COVID infections within a 24-hour period, the highest daily toll since late June. Health Minister Maxim Stepanov says 205 people have been hospitalized and told an online briefing, quote, "It means their lives are under threat, and we have to understand this disease is very serious." The number of new daily infections in Ukraine has greatly increased in the past 2 months, following the gradual lifting of restrictions that began in late May. The country's total number of cases is more than 65,000, with 1,600 lives lost. The worldwide Johns Hopkins numbers at this hour are approaching 15.8 million coronavirus infections, with a loss of over 640,000 lives. The United States recorded more than 1,000 virus fatalities for the fourth straight day yesterday. Still, a top White House advisor on the pandemic, Dr. Deborah Birx, said she saw signs that the worst could be over in hard-hit southern and western states. But she also warned the current outbreaks could move north, including the U.S. East Coast states. Total cases across the U.S. have risen to 4.1 million, with 145,000 deaths. The numbers are being driven in large part by COVID surges in Arizona, California, Florida, and Texas. Between them, those states have recorded almost 1.4 million infections and more than 46,000 fatalities. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is pushing for school children to return to in-class instruction, but there has been heavy pushback from parents, local school districts, and teachers, with many accepting the need for either remote learning or a limited number of days per week in classrooms. The top American infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says states may not necessarily have to go back to a complete shutdown, but added you certainly have to call a pause, maybe even backing up a bit. Fauci was speaking to the Washington Post. He said everybody should be trying to reopen America again, but that it should be done in accordance with set guidelines. Australia's second most populous state, Victoria, has recorded 357 new COVID-19 infections overnight, up from 300 yesterday, along with its highest daily death toll of 7. Australia has escaped the high COVID numbers of other countries, but recent flare-ups have raised anxieties. Melbourne, the country's second largest city, is under a 6-week lockdown, and the border between Victoria and New South Wales remains closed. Australia's coronavirus case count is approaching 14,000 at a cost of 145 lives so far. More news online at voanews.com. There is also a convenient, easy-to-use mobile app. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
As His Excellency assured that the state will put all measures at our disposal to ensure that perpetrators are dealt with expeditiously within the framework of the law.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio launches a special model court to combat rape and sexual violence.
We presented the request yesterday. We've acknowledged receipt. And so we're looking forward to, within the next 14 days, receiving the information from them. Once we receive the information, we would analyze it and present it to let Ghanaians know the full details of the stations that were shut down.
The Media Foundation for West Africa petitions the Ghanaian media regulator to present a list of radio stations it closed down.
This time, even our program is even more complicated because elections now in Uganda this time, making them digital is making the situation much, much worse and making our job more difficult. But we have to continue.
And the Ugandan ruling party endorses President Yoweri Museveni to seek another office term in next year's elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio launched a special model court to combat rape and sexual violence in the capital, Freetown, Friday. Officials say the court will address a sharp increase in sexual violence, including rape against women. Civil society groups have often expressed concern about the increase of rape and other sexual violence against women. They say the special model court, if replicated nationwide to fight sexual crimes, could become a significant tool in the fight against the violence. Sierra Leonean Information Minister Mohamed Rahman Sware tells me that the special model court forms part of the president's pledge to fight against the increase in rape and other forms of sexual violence.
Yes, it is true that His Excellency President Julius Maada Bio today launched the Sexual Offences Model Courts at the Lower Courts building in Freetown to ensure that the inordinate delays usually suffered by victims in pursuing justice is now history. Today, this occasion was attended by high-ranking public officials, including many judges of the High Court, Madam First Lady, cabinet ministers, and people from all walks of life, to underline the commitment this government has to ensuring that rape and sexual penetration victims or women who suffer gender-based violence get justice and on time. The court will be peopled by 20 specialized judges who will ensure that rape victims and victims of gender-based violence get timely justice. Their matters are looked into and addressed expeditiously without sacrificing the core tenets of justice, ensuring victim confidentiality, and at the same time, ensuring justice for all sides.
What is the significance of this court in the fight against rape and sexual violence against women in Sierra Leone?
This court is very significant in more ways than one. First, it now cuts down on the inordinate and torturous delays that are encountered when pursuing justice by victims of gender and sexual-based violence. You now have a court peopled by 20 specialized justices who will ensure expeditious trials and ensure that victims of rape, sexual penetration, and gender-based violence generally are heard in an expeditious manner. Unlike the past, where many in the course of pursuing justice gave up an act which more often than not emboldened the perpetrators, His Excellency has done this to send a loud and clear message that indeed the days of rape, the days of impunity, gender-based violence and related sexual offenses are over. There is no hiding place anymore for any of such offenders in Sierra Leone. It's important to note that the launch of this sexual offenses court was preceded by the launch 2 weeks ago of what we call a one-stop shop for sexual and gender-based victims, where they could get the full complement of care and support they need in 5 regional hospitals across the country.
With the launch of this court, what's next
in the fight against sexual violence against women. Will this be replicated across the country in the hinterlands as well, where stigmatization comes in with regards to sexual violence and rape?
During the launch of today's Model Courts, His Excellency paid glowing tributes to his wife, Madam First Lady, for launching the flagship campaign, Hands of Our Girls, which has been in the forefront of raising awareness and emboldening young girls and women to come out, speak up, and resist gender and sexual-based violence. This was roundly commended. In her speech, she also said to the public that the days for rapists are now numbered. No more hiding place, as His Excellency assured that the state will put all measures at our disposal to ensure that perpetrators are dealt with expeditiously within the framework of the law.
I also understand the Sierra Leonean Parliament has repealed the criminal libel law, which many say is a relief to practicing journalists and reporters in the West African nation of Sierra Leone. What is the government's position on this?
The Sierra Leone Parliament yesterday voted unanimously to expunge Part 5 of the Criminal and Seditious Libel Law of 1965 from the law books of Sierra Leone. This was a major manifesto commitment made by His Excellency the President, in spite of the fact that he was the most vilified, he was the most castigated, and he was the most libeled presidential candidate in the runoff to the 2018 elections. He did this because he is convinced that the media has a key role to play in national development. He is convinced that with the expunging of this law from the law book, Sierra Leone would now join the Civilized Committee of Nations, because with the presence of the 1965 criminal libel law on our books, Sierra Leone was already in breach of 12 international commitments to which the country is a signatory. Besides, the president believes that with the repeal, we will now be able to attract much needed foreign private sector and foreign direct investment into the Sierra Leone media. Furthermore, he also believes that with the repeal, we will be able to attract the best and the most brilliant minds in the journalism profession. Beyond the repeal, concrete safeguards have also been put in place in addition to the existing civil provisions to ensure that the rights and hard-won reputations of private citizens are expected.
Mohamed Rahman Souare is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The Media Foundation for West Africa has petitioned the Guinean National Media Commission, a media regulator, to present a list of radio stations it recently closed down. The government came under criticism after radio stations with alleged sympathies to the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, were closed down. The critics say it appears that the government is trying to muzzle the opposition ahead of the upcoming December 7 general election, but the authorities sharply deny the closures are politically motivated. They say the radio stations failed to meet requirements which enable them to legally operate. Suleimana Brahma, the executive director at the Media Foundation for West Africa, signed the petition requesting information from the Ghanaian media regulator. He tells me the National Media Commission's decision to close down the radio stations allegedly affiliated to the main opposition party appears not to be transparent.
Well, so this is an access to information request that we have filed to the National Communications Authority. And basically what we are seeking is information that would ensure that we are able to make sense in terms of frequency management in the country very transparent. In 2018-2019, a number of radio stations were shut for failure to renew their authorization. Since then, there have been debates about whether it was a fair process or it was a process that led to victimizing some radio stations that were known to be aligned to opposition parties. So the first thing we are requesting for is a full list of the stations that were shut down, their owners and their locations. And then we are also asking for the full list of currently authorized FM radio stations in the country, as well as television radio stations in the country.
Now, if I may ask you, Brahma, what will you do, or what will your organization do with this list that you've requested from the NCA?
First of all, The full list in terms of the radio stations that were shut down would enable us to know indeed it was a process that was transparent, it was a process that was fair, and indeed all stations that were not renewed at the time were shut down. Second is in terms of the currently authorized FM stations, we have gone through the database of the NCA, and what we are seeing is that there are a number of radio stations that can't find their last date of authorization, even though you can also see others where you have the last dates of authorization indicated. And so one is left with an interpretation that, well, those things with no authorization, new renewed authorization dates indicated may not have renewed. I raised it with an official of the NCA. Subsequently, the database was tweaked. And so we want them to produce to us the full list of authorized FM stations. We know whether those that are on air are all authorized in terms of stations that have fulfilled their renewal mandate.
Now, officials or the National Communication have the view that those radio stations that were shut down failed to meet certain basic requirements of them needed for them to be operational in Ghana. Flouting that law or rule or perhaps procedure could come as a result of them getting shut down. What do you say to that? Because they rejected criticisms that the shutdown were politically motivated, since it appears that those radio stations shut down were linked to the main opposition party.
Well, so when the exercise was carried out, we raised a number of concerns in terms of their own database at the time. And we saw a number of radio stations that their own database indicated had not renewed their authorization. And those stations included stations that were well known to be aligned to the government. And so we challenged them at the time to say, well, if you are saying it was a fair exercise and a transparent exercise, why don't you just publicize the name of all the stations that have been shut down? Because at the time, there were over 100 stations that were said to have flouted their authorization requirement and therefore were going to be shut down. And since then, we have constantly requested for the full list and we are constantly denied, except that they tell us, look, it was a transparent process, no station was victimized, and so on and so forth. And that is why we think it's important that we now use the law, the RTI law, to demand the full list so that we can all know it, the entire country, everybody will know, okay, these are the 100 stations that were shut down. The stations belong to A, B, C, D, E, and we can identify this as a pro-government person, that as an opposition person, so that we all settle our minds in terms of the transparency of the process.
Now, Brahma, when do you expect the NTA to respond? And I've also heard reports that the shutdown of these radio stations perhaps undermines the constitution, which stipulates free speech and freedom of association, among other things. Although some people are saying it might not necessarily be so. So when you get this information, what's next?
Per the RTI law, we are supposed to receive feedback from them within 14 days of our request. We presented the request yesterday. They've acknowledged receipt. And so we're looking forward to, within the next 14 days, receiving the information from them. Once we receive the information, we would analyze it and present it to let Ghanaians know the full details of the stations that were shut down. And of course, if there are any gaps, then the NCA would then explain to people why some stations that had not fulfilled their authorization requirements were shut down, whilst others were not shut down, what the reasons were. And of course, the bit about free speech, indeed, if it was done discriminatorily in terms of shutting down pro-opposition media houses and leaving pro-government media houses, that certainly undermines freedom of speech within a democratic environment.
Suleimana Brahma is the executive director at the Media Foundation for West Africa. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's re-election bid got a significant boost after the governing party, the National Resistance Movement, or NRM, chose him as its presidential candidate ahead of next year's general election. President Museveni was unopposed in his quest to seek an additional term in office next year. He has been the East African country's leader since 1986. Dr. Miriam Matembe is the chairperson of the Board of Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, or CCEDU. She tells me that the choice of President Museveni as the unopposed presidential candidate for the governing party is unsurprising. Ms. Matembe also says the playing field in the electoral process is not level which she says will undermine the credibility of next year's elections.
From the prime ministership, therefore, President Museveni is already so candid. He fears competition. He cannot entertain it. He can't have it. And therefore, the NRM party has never had internal democracy. So it was expected. It is not at all.
Dr. Mutembe, does this mean the people of Uganda? Because opposition groups are sharply opposed to President Museveni and his government. But he keeps winning elections. So now that they must choose him unopposed, what does this mean for the people of Uganda?
In as far as President Museveni is still the president under, elections are a formality. We never have free and fair elections. There is bribe, there is corruption, there is lying, there is violence, there is all that. They are just a formality. They are never there to deliver democracy in this country.
Does that the upcoming elections next year are not going to be free, fair, or credible?
How? They cannot. In fact, last time was the 2016 elections were clearly declared by all observers as far much below the expected standard. Right now, already, an opposition person to call a meeting or a rally or anything, they must roughed up, they must be beaten, they must be tied up and taken to prison. Whenever the NRM party has a rally or anything, nobody touches them. So, to begin, before we go to digital elections, which are completely lopsided, and those people who are not in power right now, already the ground has never been leveled. So it can't. We don't expect any free and fair and credible election. But this doesn't mean that don't continue fighting until maybe one day we shall make it. But I can assure you, as a Ugandan, speaking on behalf of the Coalition for Electoral Democracy in this country, already we know that the ground is unfavorable, is not conducive, credible elections at all.
Dr. Mutembe, does that mean that what the opposition is doing might not necessarily work? Because supporters of the NRM are saying that because of the divided opposition with no unity, no alliance in the run-up to the elections, it makes it easy for the dominance of the NRM to be perpetuated or continued, because it makes it easy for President Museveni to defeat a united opposition party.
Yes, it is quite an opposition never unite, because each of them, they are centered on themselves. Actually, they run by service. They are not driven. They are not people-centered or service-oriented. They are just self-centered, and it is all about getting power to accumulate wealth. That's what is in Uganda right now. Extremely unfortunate, but that is what it is. Otherwise, if they were united and choose one presidential candidate and rally behind that candidate, this will not necessarily guarantee success, because bridging is too much. You know, the President Museveni chooses the members of the Electoral Commission. He rules over them. That has been the situation. But if people united and came together, you never know, there could be some bit of a difference. But if you want to get united, Uganda is in Museveni is equal to his pattern to Uganda. As long as he is in power, I don't see him being removed by an election. He himself said
things that might not necessarily be free, fair, transparent, or credible. I mean that your work is made this Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda because of some of these concerns you raised?
Of course, it is difficult, but as I told you, we work. Lose hope, you see it going on, but still you continue. Because, for instance, we, as the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy, our main purpose is to see that the electoral laws are reformed whenever there is election. We look at how the necessary reforms that are needed in electoral reforms, we take them, we table them to Parliament, whether they take them or not, we take them. At times they take a little, at times they ignore everything, but we do our work. And then we do voter mobilization to make sure that voters are interested in this process of promoting, advancing democratic governance. And then we also observe and monitor elections when elections come. So we do that. Whether the atmosphere is conducive or not, we do that. Of course, we face a lot of challenges like the security people meeting you, beating you, all that kind of thing that happens here in Uganda. But we can't stop. But this time, even our problem is even more complicated because the elections now in Uganda, this time, we're making them digital is making the situation much, much worse and making our job more difficult. But we have to continue.
Dr. Miriam Matembe is the chairperson of the Board of Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, the leader of the Ugandan People Power Movement, a political pressure group, has unveiled a new political party in the run-up to next year's general election. Popular parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, launched the National Unity Platform with an umbrella as its symbol this week. Leading members of the party say Bobi Wine will be the new party's candidate to challenge incumbent President Yoweri Museveni in the presidential poll. Analysts say there are too many opposition parties seeking to challenge the president. They contend that a lack of unity or an alliance with a single presidential candidate creates the opportunity for President Museveni to win re-election. Joel Senyoni, a leading member of the People Power Movement, tells me that the new party and the People Power Movement will enable opposition groups to rally around a core objective to defeat President Museveni and his governing National Resistance Movement Party in next year's election.
Yes, so when we started the People Power Movement about 3 years ago, really the intention was let's get everybody on board. Let's be an all-inclusive entity. And at the time, we didn't think it was necessary to form a political party. But we have always worked, you know, with political parties, engaged them and all of that, moved together. But as we headed to the election, of course, questions kept arising, you know, what exactly, what registered political entity are we going to use? You know, what symbol are we going to use? All of these really being valid questions. And so it was important that we get to address those questions and henceforth get to formalize in that respect, have a political vehicle that we're going to use and for that matter, symbol.
What makes this your new political party unique among all political parties or opposition political parties in Uganda?
It might not necessarily be unique, I'd say. It's a political party like all the others, but I guess the peculiar nature about it is when it's new and it's being taken up by the People Power Movement. And so we're saying the People Power Movement has now acquired this as a political vehicle, okay? But also, it's a breath of fresh air, really, because, you know, increasingly people are beginning to get tired of political parties. There's many scrambles there and so on, so many fights going on. And some people see this as a breath of fresh air. Now, we're not oblivious to the fact that, you know, we too will encounter challenges, but we have learned from the existing political parties, and we believe we'll try and know which gaps to fill and what to take care of.
Now, Joel, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that there needs to be an alliance if President Museveni should be defeated? And they said all of you, opposition parties, have one objective and one objective only, to defeat President Museveni at the ballot box. So they say that the announcement of new political parties basically further divisions the front of the opposition in the run-up to the election, which basically paves way for President Museveni to win the presidential vote. Do you think their assessment is correct?
So to make any alliances are made by, you know, entities that are registered. So ours previously wasn't registered. Now it is. And so it becomes easy to form an alliance and all of that because our law talks about alliances of registered entities. So People Power Movement, you know, was not registered. And so it was difficult to form an alliance. So this now puts us in very good position to say, okay, we can now work alongside this one, this entity, and all of that for the upcoming election. So forming the alliance becomes a lot easier in the state we are in, our newly acquired state now.
So looking forward, what is the message to the people of the Uganda here concerning the arrival of the latest or newest political party on the political scene in Uganda?
I think ours really is to tell them that let's brace ourselves for change. We needed a vehicle which we get to use for this change that we are, you know, all working hard to achieve. There will be challenges, but let's get ready to face them. And really what we're telling Ugandans is the time is now. The time is now, and it's good that now we have gotten organized this way. Let's go for it. Let's, everybody get to play their part. It's not just a question of Honorable Chagulanyi, Joel, and the other leaders. All of us really should be a part of this.
Before you go, Joel, what is your reaction when President Museveni recently fired about 8 officials at the Electoral Commission? Some people are worried that the firing of those people will mean that he will name new people who will do his bidding and ensure the upcoming elections next year will tilt in his favor so he could win easily. What is your take on this?
Well, even those that were fired really were doing his bidding. You know, I've had rumors. I'm not confirmed them yet, really, because the party that we have acquired, you know, has been around for quite a bit of time. Mr. Museveni could not allow us to form a political party previously. In fact, he used his students to try and register the name People Power so that we don't get to use it. So he obviously wasn't going to allow us to form a political party. So we just had to acquire one. And we did all of that behind the radar, clandestinely, until the unveil. So many people were caught unawares, and there are some rumors, unconfirmed though, that these people who were fired, you know, questions were asked, how did Honorable Chagulanyi, Senator Bobi Wine, acquire this political party without you? How did you not know about all of this? So there's too many conspiracy theories out there.
Joel Senyonyi is a leading member of the People Power Movement. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Nigeria, officials in Cross River State say a rescue mission has been launched to locate and free the Chinese construction workers recently abducted by an unknown group. They say although the kidnappings appear to be on the rise across the country, Cross River State has not been adversely affected due to security measures implemented to combat the menace. The workers were abducted at a quarry site in Akamka. Asu Okan, Commissioner for Information in the state, says the local authorities have gathered enough intelligence to help with the rescue mission. His remarks come after local media reported a police officer working with the Chinese workers was killed during the abduction. Asu Okan tells me that residents are sure that local authorities will ensure their protection after stepping up efforts to bolster security in Cross River State.
Governor Ben Ayede has been able to put in together core security measures to ensure that our people remain safe and even visitors into the state. The homeland security is more of a door-to-door security apparatus that ensures that you can call the next minute, just a few minutes away, and you find the Homeland Security at your doorstep. It's basically the first door-to-door security apparatus in Nigeria. But talking about the kidnapped Chinese internationals, we did not expect that if there was adequate cover or perhaps information, that would have happened. Perhaps the nationals themselves maybe took for granted the fact that they were already on ground and there was some level of familiarity with the people, and perhaps almost took for granted the fact that an investment on their security. If they had the number of security men on the ground, but for the one or two that they had and one was killed, I am sure that if they had taken it for granted, maybe this would have happened. It's unfortunate, and we take the blame as a government.
Has the state government, the Cross River State government, launched a rescue operation vis-a-vis deploying the security apparatus to seek to rescue these abducted workers?
I can tell you authoritatively that yes, that has been done. We have launched a rescue mission on getting back those nationals in their best form, unhurt, and coming back as safe as possible. We have engaged the community boys around the area because we believe that there is nothing that can happen around that particular area without some of the boys having a fair knowledge of those who did it. So we are engaging the community people. We have also engaged the security agencies are top on their toes. The search is ongoing. Packs have also been deployed through the creek and possible hideouts for kingpin. We expect we have started getting some relevant information from our search party.
Has any group or individuals admitted responsibility, or have they confessed? Has anybody or any group claimed responsibility for the abduction of these Chinese workers?
Well, not any group has come out. You know, the level of kidnap in our state, because it's very minimal, we haven't gotten to that point of insecurity where abduction will be made and a group of people will come out to say we are taking responsibility, we are taking, we are saying we are the ones who did it. No, it hasn't degenerated to that level. As a government, we move in clearly, not just to get you, but to destroy and seize every property that is gotten out of this EOL. So, yes, no team has come out, and they can never, because Cross-River State has not degenerated to that level. These are just pockets of very few cases in our state, and we are doing everything humanly possible to nip it in the bud.
So how is the government reassuring residents of Cross-River State or citizens of Cross-River State that this kidnapping that has occurred might not happen again, particularly because of measures your administration has implemented to nip it in the bud, as you said?
I think one of the critical directives His Excellency the Governor, Senator Professor Ben Ayede, has issued is that we must re-engage or perhaps re-energize the Cross-River State Homeland Security. Recruitment is already ongoing for more personnel, and the governor has also promised that they are going to release more vehicles for the Homeland Security, the door-to-door security, which is the Cross-River State Homeland Security. So as I speak with you, more personnel are being recruited into the Cross-River State Homeland Security. More vehicles are going to be released, especially from the COVID-19 convoy. Now that it looks like everything is bowing down on COVID-19, there may be an immediate need to convert some of the, out of the 100 vehicles that were bought for the COVID-19 vaccine, there may become an immediate need for us to convert some of the COVID-19 vehicles for use by the Cross-River State Homeland Security. And so now that the federal government has kind of heeded to our cry by extending the hand save on Operation Delta State to Cross-River, we expect that the creeks will be safer through the Ekang border, through the Bakassi end, and then through also the Esubutan where you have the quarry. So clearly, they will be working alongside with the expanded frontiers of the Cross-River State Homeland Security, and by the grace of God, we will have this to meet. We have about 14 exit and entry points into in and out of our state. These entry points have been re-energized, exit points have been re-energized, and the governor has given a marching order for full policing, both of the conventional Nigerian police and the members of the Nigerian Civil Defense Corps, and also working together with the community vigilante.
Asu Okang is the Commissioner for Information in Nigeria's Cross-River State. He spoke with me from the Cross-River State's capital, Calabar. Calling it a move to normalize the country's agricultural sector, the Zimbabwean government is making overtures to compensate white commercial farmers who lost property in the controversial land reform program of the 2000s. For VOA, Adi Gondo has more from Bulawayo.
The government has proposed a multi-billion-dollar compensation offer to about 3,500 white former commercial farmers whose land was appropriated by the state during the fast-track land reform program. The resettlement program to acquire more than 3,000 farms for redistribution was announced in July 2000. By February 2001, 2,706 farms covering more than 6 million hectares were listed for compulsory acquisition. The Commercial Farmers Union, CFU, which represents the large-scale commercial farming sector, says more than 1,600 commercial farms were occupied, some violently by black settlers led by war veterans in 2000. Over the years, the agricultural sector has fallen into the doldrums because some land went to people with no experience in farming, contributing to food insecurity that has been exacerbated by years of successive droughts. The Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, warned in December 2001 that the already tight food situation has deteriorated as a result of reduced cereal production and general economic decline. Grain Millers Association of Zimbabwe, for example, says the country requires 450,000 tons of wheat annually, and that production stands at just 150,000 tons. The rest has to be imported. The government says it has given partial payments to nearly 1,000 farmers since 2018 for improvements they made while still on the farms. It also says over 900 mostly elderly former landowners who are struggling financially have registered for compensation under the interim relief payment scheme being coordinated by the government and the Commercial Farmers Union, CFU. Government has paid out $55,000 each to around 700 farmers over the last 12 months. The chairperson of the Matabeleland chapter of the Commercial Farmers Union, Winston Babbage, weighs in.
As farmers in Matabeleland, we are grateful that the government is now compensating these white guys, because as farmers, we want to go on. We want to turn the page and carry on forward. Remember, the International Committee was not recognizing newly resettled farmers because of this compensation. Once they get the money, what a pleasure. We can carry on, and farming can carry on going on.
Babbage added that he assumes government is in talks with the donor community and the British government to fund the compensation. Economic analyst Tim Sansibanda has his doubts, saying constitution says all land belongs to the state, and that includes properties confiscated from white commercial farmers. Sibanda says US $3.5 billion is the ballpark figure for compensating them, and it's unclear where the money would come from.
The donors have been very clear. They're not going to pay. The contract that has been proposed, that Zimbabwe government is going to pay for improvement, inventory and improvement.
Some farmers who have since migrated prefer international arbitration for the loss of their farms. He says for compensation to be possible, much work remains.
For Zimbabwe to pay farmers, as a country, we need to develop that capacity, the capacity to pay farmers. And that means we should get the economy running. So how do we get the economy running? Through agriculture and all the value chain. And to get people to invest in agriculture, what we should do, because people have lost faith and so on and so on. And it involves setting up a sovereign wealth fund, and that sovereign wealth fund will then be used to support the local currency.
Sibanda says commercial banks, which used to fund commercial agriculture, don't trust the 99-year leases that were handed to resettled farmers. The World Food Programme says over 7 million Zimbabweans are food insecure, and much of the blame has been placed on the land reform programme, which critics say, though necessary, was done haphazardly for political expediency rather than to empower landless black Zimbabweans. According to Babbage, some of the white former commercial farmers are engaged in joint venture farming projects, especially in the province of Mashonaland. Whilst government is in a process of controversially repossessing land, which it says is not being properly used. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigo in Bulawayo.
The Malawian Anti-Corruption Bureau has arrested four top officials of the country's main power utility on charges they used their positions to illegally obtain about $5 million worth of materials. The arrests are part of an ongoing anti-corruption crackdown started when new President Lazarus Chakwera took office. For VOA, Lamek Masina has the story from the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
The Anti-Corruption Bureau says in a statement those arrested Thursday are the former CEO, board chairperson, director of procurement, and senior procurement officer of the Electricity Supply Commission of Malawi, ESCOM. A great Andala is a spokesperson for the Anti-Corruption Bureau.
These people are suspected of abusing their offices when they were in those positions through the procurement that happened at ESCOM without following proper procedures.
Ndala said the four committed the alleged offences in 2016 and are currently being interrogated. They are expected taken to court within 48 hours as required by the law. ESCOM has long been associated with the alleged corrupt practices that have crippled operations at the National Power Utility. In October 2018, a local newspaper reported that the utility offered contracts to companies not registered with the government and avoided clearance by oversight bodies by splitting up procurement deals. Currently, ESCOM is also being investigated for other scandals, including theft of 4.2 million liters of diesel, meant for backup generators at the power plants. The arrests are part of an anti-corruption crackdown initiated after new president Lazarus Chakwera took office following his victory in the June election. The former ruling Democratic Progressive Party, now in the opposition, says the campaign amounts to political persecution, allegations the new administration denies. Mustafa Hussein is a political science lecturer in Chancellor College at the University of Malawi.
I think it should not look like targeting DPP. It should be targeting those people with cases to answer. So it would be inappropriate for the new government to target only those who seem to be supporters of DPP, even those who are in the new government. If there are issues, they should do equally be pursued.
Among those recently arrested was a bodyguard of former President Peter Mutharika for allegedly helping Mutharika avoid nearly $7 million in import duties. However, Hussein doubts the 80-year-old Mutharika will be arrested or prosecuted.
Why I don't envisage that scenario, it's because of the age factor. I think the current government wouldn't want to go that far as to be seen as persecuting an old man. But that does not mean he does not have a case to answer. Now, I understand he was already interrogated, according to the report.
The Anti-Corruption Bureau said Malawians should expect more arrests, though, as it steps up investigations of alleged corrupt practices, most of which took place under the former Mutharika administration. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
You've noticed I've been standing up, Madui, wamenizidi pesa na umri na shanga. Sijui, au tuseme nina kibwe. Nakata, wanidai, siwadai. Ila na shanga, wananichukia. Chuki zisizo sababu. Wanatinya mbuzi kafari. Ili asile apote. Ona wanavyo mwaka he. Ya Mungu baba unitete. Wanamiriki mafogi fogi. Wanashinana na midongote. Wana wish hata nishiwe kodi. Ni tange tange wanizome. Ni mnyonge. Biblia nani kama si wewe. Kisa tonge. Wanafania waniondo. Ninajikaza hivyo. Ninajikaza hivyo. Shindana na we mpaka napiga magoti namlilia mama mama kisha narudi kwako umlaze salama sawa nyinyi manoti noti utakutana kiyama nyonge narudi kwako kwako maurana wanachinya mbuzi kafari ili asile apote ona wanavyo mwaga he. Mungu baba unitete. Wana miriki mafogi fogi. Wana shinana na midongote. Wana wish hata nishiwe kodi. Ni tange tange wanizome. Ni mnyonge. Biblia nani kama si wewe. Kisa tonge. Wanafania waniondo. Ninajikaza hivyo. Ninajikaza hivyo. Ninajikaza hivyo.
Todi. What shall we do?
Tingadi.
Sinzija.
What shall we do?
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when the vine entwines your roof, it is time to cut it down. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.